Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, we are on the air. I'm Dr. Victator. Neil is absent and probably at home, not God knows doing what. I'm going to be talking to former Spider-Man editor Danny Fingeroff now. As soon as he calls in. I had a great talk with Steve Englehart the other day, but as soon as I got off the air, I realized that I completely blanked on asking him about the Vision and the Scarlet Witch miniseries. Which is weird, because I think I read that probably 100 times back in the late 90s. Yeah, that's just how things were then, though. I buy books that I think I got out of the quarter bin and also at various dollar boxes. It was a really good series. I enjoyed it. I thought it really did a lot to expand. Not expand, but it made Vision and Scarlet Witch much more interesting. And then it kind of got all torn to hell a couple of years later during the John Byrne run, which was good stories in itself, but I feel like some stuff was kind of, that some of that stuff should have kind of stuck around. I'm just waiting for Danny to call in, and then we'll get to talking about Spider-Man, Marvel Saga, maybe Darkhawk, things like that. Hopefully I'll have a few more shows scheduled, because I do have a few more guests down the pipeline. Hold on one second, Ann. Hello, Danny.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Ended up being kind of late at night last night. All right, so last time I was talking to you, we had gotten in talking a little bit about editing Spider-Man books. You mentioned that you had done the book before with during the Tom DeFalco run, wasn't it, with Ron Frenz?
Right.
Right. Can you tell me, how did editing the book then differ? How was that different than when you edited it the second time?
Huh. Well, I guess a big difference was that Jim Shooter was editor-in-chief in the 80s, and Tom DeFalco was editor-in-chief in the 90s. So I think philosophically they were, in terms of what made for a good story, they were in agreement. But there was sort of a different atmosphere around the office, you know, so that I think there was a little more room for experimentation in the 90s than there was in the 80s. On the other hand, in the 80s, there was more of an adherence to sort of traditional storytelling values. You know, so I guess let me turn it around on you. As a reader, how did you feel they were different, if you were reading them, or if you read both those?
Well, yeah, it's weird because I didn't start reading till 91, but I read the back issues concurrently.
Uh huh.
And I think in the 80s, sometimes the book seemed a lot more structured, but I think it's just because there weren't as many of them.
Because why?
I don't think there was as many Spider-Man books, so it seemed a little more focused, but in the 90s,
yeah,
there were so many more.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good point. There were still three monthly Spider-Man titles in the 80s, but there weren't as many miniseries and spin-offs and books with second-string characters getting their own titles. That's true. But I think that Shooter and DeFalco shared the same philosophy of structure, but I think DeFalco was willing to let people play around a little more within that. You know, I guess maybe in some ways the most emblematic thing was Todd McFarlane's changing or evolving the spider webbing from kind of what had been done from Ditko and Romita on into what became called, I think Tom actually coined the phrase, the spaghetti webbing, you know, which gave a whole, you know, kind of a new look and feel to the webbing and to the way Spider-Man moved and looked in general. You know, I guess the 90s was also an era, although not quite so much in the Spider-Man books, where the artist started to predominate, you know, sort of the era, you know, before and during the creation of Image Comics, so that, you know, again, not, less so in the Spider-Man office than in other offices, but the idea that the artist would dictate kind of the aesthetic of the comic and the stories were more visually driven and, you know, it's sort of what the early 90s sort of became famous for, and then and of course after that the pendulum swung the other way where things became very, very writing dominated.
All right, that's a good point you brought. That reminded me of something. You know, you were the editor when the Todd McFarlane written Spider-Man title started up, weren't you?
You know, I wasn't. Jim Salicrup was.
I was there
just at the tail end of Todd being on the what we call the adjectiveless Spider-Man book. So you know, and I had a famous conflict with him over the what's the name of the Juggernaut eye poking situation. You know, is this familiar to you?
You know, there's some things there were a little bit of lore to me. Actually, no, I know what you're talking about. Were you mentioning the issue with the X-Force crossover?
Yeah, it was the only issue of that. It was the only issue I ever edited Todd on, and you know, I mean, he's got his own version of this, and I want to hasten to add that you know, Todd and I are friendly, and he's done me many favors over the years, and when I was editing Right Now magazine for Tomorrow's and all sorts of other times. So, you know, this was a conflict for me as an editor, and obviously when you're dealing with someone who was as big in that era as Todd, you know, and that was probably, you know, he'd done Amazing Spider-Man, and then he did the book that was just called Spider-Man, and he was riding about as high as anybody could ride, and then took it to another level when he did Spawn over an Image, and then went on to the toy company, and you know, he's the you know, phenomenon we know as Todd McFarlane today. But as an editor, I had certain responsibilities, I felt, to the character and to the company, and so Todd had drawn a scene in which the character Juggernaut gets stabbed in the eye by one of the member of X-Force who had that double, that sword with the double blade. And I knew the minute I saw it that it violated the comics code, and so I went to talk to you know, my immediate superior, sort of the way Marvel was structured. You know, Tom was the editor in chief, and then underneath him were a trio of executive editors, including Mark Gruenwald. And Gruenwald was the one I reported to, but you know, but everyone was free to go to Tom. It was not, there was a structure, but it wasn't all that formal in practice. So I said, look, I got this thing. It violates the comics code. On the other hand, it's Todd McFarlane. What do we do? And Gruenwald pointed out that that aside from whether it violated the code or not, it violated the character, you know, Juggernaut's powers, that he had a permanent force field around him, and you couldn't poke him in the eye. Anyway, so it became a big tempest in the teapot. And, you know, I think somewhere in there, Todd left the magazine. His first child had just been born, and he wanted to spend time with her. And look, I think he felt he had enough clout that he didn't have to take editorial direction. You know, because Tom had offered to him. He said, "Well, look, we can't print it as is, but I'm happy to engage in a dialogue with you in the letters pages and in the bullpen bulletins, and why don't we, you know, take it to the fans and explain to them, you know, the way things work and make a healthy debate out of it." I think Todd was out the door already. I think he, if he didn't go, then he would have gone 3 months later. He was just somebody who was, too big for Marvel. He was kind of the spark plug behind the creation of Image and went and did it. But that was but what I appreciated was that Todd never took it to a personal level. I've had disagreements with other creators where somehow it became a personal thing, whereas Todd always kept it on a professional level, which I always appreciated. And as I say, I've done things with him, and he's done things. I've done interviews with him and other events and writing, and but that. So that was, but at Marvel at the time, that was the extent of my working with Tom, was that one issue. That had probably been preceded by a situation when I was given that book to edit, and the other Spider-Man books, again in 1990, at the very end of 1990. And then I think 6 months later, I got the Amazing Spectacular and Web at the end of 90, and then in somewhere in 91, I got Todd's book, and it was way behind schedule, and we had not, the industry and the company had not yet gotten to a phase where it was common practice to wait for the artists. It was being done some, because there's always that question: do the readers want the issue on time, and it's more important that it be on the stands than who's doing it, or is the style and identity and presence of a specific creator more important? Well, at that point, my directive was get the book on time. I slated in and printed an issue written and drawn by Eric Larson that featured Spider-Man and the Beast and the X-Men. So I would imagine that Todd was probably not pleased that we had put in an issue by somebody else during his run, but we did so. So I don't remember him specifically complaining about it, but I'm sure he would rather that we had just stalled. But for the company, and hence for Tom, and hence for me, to miss an issue of a comic that sold as well as that was a matter of missing an opportunity for a large profit that month, by missing it. So that was my mandate from several levels above me to do that. Anyway, that's a very long answer to a short question.
I recently, because we've talked about this a little bit online, you were editor of Marvel Saga, which was a book. It was a very ambitious project in the 80s. I don't even think it'd be possible now, but can you help me a little bit about the process that went behind making that book?
That was, some of the most fun I had in comics. I was freelancing, that project had been have been developed in a very general sense. I forget if it was Shooter, Grunewald, Peter Sanderson. Somebody came up with sort of a general idea for it. And I think Peter was always attached to it. You know, Peter is sort of one of the foremost historians of comics, and later on went on to become, for a number of years, Marvel's in-house archivist in the days when the company felt it was important to spend money on actually having somebody take care of the archives and maintain a close record of the continuity of all the comics. So Peter and I had to figure out, so it was Peter Sanderson, and I think at one point, you know, the different ideas we ran through were, in case anybody doesn't know, the Marvel Saga is a comic that it's called, the subtitle was The Official History of the Marvel Universe. And so it, you know, Marvel had started in 1961, and, you know, Stan and Jack and Steve and Don Heck and Larry Lieber and Dick Ayers, you know, all the Joe Sinnott, I'm sure, no matter how many people I name, I'm sure I'll leave somebody out inadvertently, but they, you know, they were doing comics that had a common continuity thread simply because Stan was the editor on all of them and the writer on many of them, and on most of them. And so they had a consistency that comics had not had before. You know, so they developed what was called the Marvel Universe. And over, you know, and over years there would be a continuity implant. Someone, in other words, someone would come up, it's got another name also, but, you know, someone would come up with a clearer explanation or an expansion of a story that had been published years before. It's also called, oh, what the heck, it's called retro, I'll think of the word for it, but, you know, again, explaining, contradicting, expanding on, clarifying things that may have just been alluded to in the days when no one thought that this thing called the Marvel Universe would last more than a few years. You know, it was not a planned universe; it just evolved. The idea was to take all these, you know, up until then, I guess it was about 1985, to take all of the various additions to and expansions on the continuity that have been done and make them into one more or less seamless story. And I guess a big decision was, were we going to have it be all new material, or were we going to go with mostly reprint material from older comics with some new material and a lot of bridging text. So we went with the latter. I wish I could remember exactly why we did that, but it was obviously cheaper to not use original art, but I don't think that was a factor. I don't remember there being financial pressure like that. I think the idea was, you know, it's funny, we were close enough to the origins of the universe. It was quote only unquote, you know, 20, it was, 25 years since the Marvel Universe had been created, although actually longer than that, more like, 45 or 50 years since the very beginnings with the Human Torch and Captain America and Submariner and the other timely characters, because their continuity had been woven into the Marvel Universe. It was 25 fewer years than it is now, you know, or more close to 30 fewer years. So it seemed like there was still an interest and appreciation among the readership and among the potential readership for a comic like that of the original artwork from the original stories. So we went with that. And it was an open-ended project. You know, it No one said to us it has to be 12 issues or 20 issues. It was just sort of do it. So that's what we did, you know. In retrospect, it might have made more sense to have said it's a 12-issue project, so fit everything in. But it was, but we didn't, and people seem to enjoy it. I know they've done a couple of reprint editions. And, what we did was we managed to tie in a lot of stuff that people had not really thought about how it fitted in together or might have been summarized as how certain events fit together in entries in the Marvel Universe Handbook. But, it was a real challenge to try to put this stuff together in sequence, and how do you make art that was done in 1961 mesh with art that was done in 1981? Excuse me. So that was the origin of it, and I think, it would not surprise me if there were writers or editors who, to a degree, used it today. Although I'm sure a lot of the continuity in it has been contradicted or modified in the years since by the hundreds of people writing the thousands of stories that have come since then.
One thing, I didn't make the connection, but one of the earliest comics I got back when I was first reading comics was a book called Spider-Man Saga, and it did something similar to Marvel Saga with Spider-Man,
right.
with Spider-Man, and how did that come about?
I think that was inspired by... I was there, I edited the last couple of issues, but I didn't initiate that project. But I would imagine that somebody saw Marvel Saga and either Peter, I'm not sure who, I don't remember, do you remember who the writer was on that? There were several writers, I think, no? On Spider-Man Saga?
Yeah, I lost that book so many years ago, but it just had a really special place for me because I remember when I was first getting into comics, and it really helped me learn the history of Spider-Man. I remember I just went over the first issue so many times.
Uh-huh, that's interesting. I think the idea was just to do the same, similar thing as Marvel Saga, but with a single character, and certainly Spider-Man, had a rich enough history, and a history that had so many... continuity implants and retroactive continuity, that it made sense to do with him. You could do it with the X-Men, you could do it with the Fantastic Four, you could do it, I guess those would be the big characters who people would want to see something like that for. It seemed to be an era where... there was sort of an interest, which I think there probably still is today, but in encyclopedic treatment of the characters and of the continuity, but I think a lot of it was probably sparked by the awareness that in 1986 would be the 25th anniversary of Fantastic Four number one. Just like what was it last year? I guess 2 years ago would have been the 50th anniversary, and then last year would have been Spider-Man's 50th anniversary. So I think when modern Marvel turned 25, I think it was considered cool that the characters had that longer continuity. I get the sense now that say you have Superman's 75th birthday is this month. Action Comics 1 cover dated June, but came out in April. And the Marvel, the Avengers, X-Men are turning 50 this year, and I get the sense that there's a little hesitation on the part of the companies to acknowledge that somewhere they seem hesitant to there seems to be, you know, I'm just, you know, I mean, I'm, this is not based on any insider knowledge, just it seems to me that they're not making big deals over these anniversaries because they don't want to be perceived as old. You know, somehow it's not legacy anymore, and it's not tradition, and it's not history. It's people think we're old, you know. So I think they're missing a bet by not capitalizing more on those big milestone anniversaries, but they must have their reasons.
Do you think that the lawsuits over the years might have anything to do with it?
Oh, geez. I don't know. I mean, they're doing movies, they're doing video games. I get, you know, I mean, you know, a lawsuit's a lawsuit. I guess you have to figure that in, but I think for, you know, I mean, you and I, you know, and the people we know are aware of and, you know, and interested in that stuff. But I have a feeling that for 99% of the public, you know, they're either not aware of the lawsuits, or they, you know, or they just see it as sort of more showbiz infighting, you know. So I, you know, whether it would give fodder to either, you know, say to people challenging the copyrights of the companies, I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, so maybe an intellectual property or an entertainment lawyer would caution the companies not to emphasize the legacy, but just as an industry insider and as a watcher of the industry, I don't think so. But you could, you know, you never know. That could be a factor.
Okay, I was just curious about it. One of the things you did, you had a lot of writing credits on What If Volume 2, and I was wondering about that. When you would do an issue of What If, did you come up with the premise, or would the editor have a premise and you had to make it work?
I think in almost every case I came up with the premise. You know, the general guideline with What If was to do a an alternate version of a storyline that had been popular. So, you know, so that was sort of the mandate in general. And I think the editor was Craig Anderson, and he and I had a very good creative connection. And he liked, which is a fancy way of saying he liked my writing, you know. So he was always eager to take pitches from me, and we had a similar sensibility. You know, what if is sort of, you know, the difference we used to say. I think this probably came from Gruenwald, but I could be wrong. About the. Say DC had what they called imaginary stories, as opposed to the, you know, to the journalistic documentation that was the rest of the of the comics. You know, imaginary stories meant that people could act out of character. People could, you know, Superman could marry Lois. Superman could return to Krypton. You know, Batman could have saved his parents. You know, 100 different. You know, imaginary stories. What If always depended, and I think this went back to the days when Roy Thomas originated the first What If series, it had to do with kind of a turning point in the regular continuity where something different would happen or someone would make a different decision that would take their life in a different direction. And that was tricky because, you know, if the assumption is that the writers, artists, and editors know these characters so well that when a character makes an important decision in a story, you know the definition, or one of the definitions of a great story, is something where the ending is surprising but inevitable. You know, you're surprised by what happens, but if you think back on it, you go, well, that's the only way it could have turned out. So the trick with What If was to have a character make a different decision, or to have things happen in a different way, but have the characters be true to themselves, have the characters remain in character. And I think the ones I did, usually succeeded like that, because, you know, when a person makes, you know, when you make a decision in your life, a big important life decision, you know, very often you could have made the other decision. You know, there's, you know, you may have been like 51% decided one thing and 49% with the other thing, and you ultimately had to take action. But on a different day, you might have gone 51-49 in the other direction. So that was sort of the approach that I took in the What If stories I did. But they were always fun. They were, you know, they were not unlike the Marvel saga in that they required a lot of research into continuity and sort of figuring out key moments in Marvel history and how would they have been different without just throwing credibility out the window, without making somebody act totally out of character, you know, keeping them consistent to who they were established as being and still, still having them, having things work out differently. So that was always the challenge and the fun of What If. Plus, you know, I got to sort of play in a lot of different characters' playgrounds and work with a lot of terrific artist. I remember I worked early on in his career with Mark Bagley and with Greg Capullo and Ron Lim and Jim Valentino. Again, I'm sure I'm leaving people out, but that's, you know, it was a fun kind of comic to do.
Okay, let me take this to Spider-Man. Later on, when you were editor of the Spider-Man books, and What If you Spider-Man, would they have to go through the Spider-Man office to get permission?
Everything, you know, that's a good question. Because obviously if you had asked me, what about guest starring Spider-Man, say, anytime, certainly by the 90s and before that, by the 80s, you had to get permission to guest star a character, which could not be withheld unreasonably, but there were, you know, but had to be, you know, in keeping with what was going on in the character's own book. So, I mean, say an extreme example would be if the world were to think that a certain character was dead, then you could not have that character just showing up. Also, there were certain characters like Spider-Man and Wolverine and for a time, the Punisher, that everybody wanted to use all the time, and there had to be some regulating of the usage of those characters. So for What If, you know, I think the plots were run by the editors of the characters being used just to make sure that there was, you know, there was consistency in the usage of their powers and of the backstory, you know. But I don't know if there would ever have been a reason for the editor to say, you know, hold off a month or two, or don't do this story. You know, I mean, the whole point of What If was that they established a new line of continuity for the characters involved. So, as I said, I think I'm pretty sure that those stories would have been shown to the editors of the characters. I know what you're saying. When I was editing Spider-Man, who approved it? I guess I did. I have a feeling I probably showed it to whoever was my assistant at the time or one of the editors in the Spider-Man group just to make sure, or maybe even to Tom or Mark. You know, this is a little vague in my mind who, if anybody, had to approve what ifs that I wrote with characters. In them that I was the editor of. It was a little different when I wrote Dark Hawk and I guest starred Spider-Man or characters from Spider-Man. You know, as I recall, I gave myself permission to do it. Hopefully I did not abuse the great power, the great responsibility that came with the great power entrusted to me.
Let me ask you about Dark Hawk. How did you get the job writing that book?
Let's see. I had been freelance for a few years, then I came back on staff. And I was supposed to be editing the comic, actually. And I was having a hard time putting a team together. Various people came and went, and they just, it didn't seem to solidify. You know, people would be hired, then they'd get other offers that were, that had tighter deadlines or that sort of were going to be more lucrative, you know. You can, since there were royalties being paid on the comics, and you know, certain things were sort of known that they would be popular and would be ordered, have high orders and high sales. So I think I was a little frustrated with it. The character had started with like a 4-page. Kind of mini Bible written by Tom DeFalco, and it was part of sort of a planned, controlled rollout of new characters for Marvel, where I think they would launch 12 new titles a year, and they'd figure that 6 of them would be canceled. You know, it was a rational, sane approach to line expansion. Needless to say, that didn't last very long because the big boom came and we suddenly were mandated to put out, you know, as many new comics as possible because everything was selling. However, Dark Hawk was part of sort of that controlled rollout period. And I guess I was talking to Tom one day and he just said to me, why don't you write it? And you know, and that was an era where it was common for editors to write or do other freelance work or coloring or in some rare cases drawing, but it was, you know, the idea was you'd supplement your income by writing and you'd also sort of maintain an understanding of what your freelancers were going through. So that was, so Tom said, why don't you write it? And I think Greg Wright was, then became the editor, and Greg and I worked on kind of expanding and developing and modifying Tom's original premise, Tom's original mini Bible, into the character. And then we had Keith Pollard attached to it, but he ended up not drawing it, and Mike Manley came on and designed the character that we know. So that was, you know, things were sort of informal then at the office, and as I say, there seems to be an edict now about editors not doing regular freelance work, but then it was really, you know, from the beginning of the industry and the company, and certainly then it was just something that was done, and there were various checks and balances in place to try to ensure that sort of thing was not abused. You know, I think the reason it's not done now is because people, I don't know, somewhere somebody thought, well, how can these guys be, you know, on staff and, you know, and also be freelancers, and won't people be tempted to give work just to their friends or cronies and blah, blah, blah. All I know is that under that system, some great comics came out, and they came out consistently, and it came out by people who understood the characters and the comics and what was necessary. I've answered like half a dozen questions you never asked, but that's how I started writing a Dark Hawk, and then I continued writing it under when Howard Mackey became editor, who was wonderful to work with, and under Nelson Yumtov, who also was swell. And Greg was, you know, I was very lucky with all the editors on Dark Hawk. Greg Wright, Howard Mackey, Nell Yumtov. It was, it was work. You know, coming up with stories for a character month after month. It's hard. That's why they pay you for it. But that character was fun. And, you know, the mandate was to create Spider-Man for the 90s, which is, in a way, sort of what we try to do every day. But this was a character who specifically was designed to play that role. And I think that, you know, I think we updated him. I think the original premise had involved Chris Powell. That was Dark Hawk, his father, being murdered, you know, sort of in a mode kind of like Spider-Man's origin or Batman's. And, you know, I came up with the twist on it that rather than do that for another character, why not have him, you know, sort of see his father as a role model in terms of ethics and morality and behavior, and then see his father do something, you know, specifically taking... his father was a police officer, so seeing his father take a payoff from a gangster, and how would that affect Chris, who would then become Dark Hawk? How would he feel about seeing, you know, these ideals his father had passed down to him be betrayed by his father? What would that do to his own ideals? Would it make him abandon them? Would it make him fight for them even harder? So I thought that was in many ways more kind of a nice twist on the classic superhero traumatic death origin.
Dark Hawk, near the end of the run, I'm not sure if it was concurrently while it was being published, but eventually Dark Hawk became a member of the Avengers, and I was wondering, was that something set up when the book was still going?
Well, he became a member of the West Coast Avengers at first.
Right.
And then he also became affiliated, I guess he was also kind of a auxiliary member of the New Warriors. You know, I mean, so it was one of those things where I was editing the New Warriors, so having Dark Hawk be in it now and then made sense in terms of cross-promotion for both comics. And sort of a logical thing for teenage heroes to play in the same ballpark. And I think Nelson was the editor of West Coast Avengers. So again, it was sort of a natural thing for him to think of. And the continuity, and because he was the editor of both those books, the continuities could be coordinated well, and they wouldn't have to go to another office for permission. Or to know exactly where in their ongoing saga a particular character was. So, did Dark Hawk become a member of the regular Avengers at some point?
I don't think he did. He
yeah.
would show up sometimes when they would have those big, you know, when they called in everyone, he would
right.
show up for a panel or two.
Yeah, he was in the Infinity Crusade, which was, I guess, one of the big Jims. But again, one of the big Jim Starlin Thanos storyline. So I think Dark Hawk was in that. Yeah, he would take part in most of those big company wide crossovers. You know, it seemed like it couldn't hurt. You know, it just seemed like it would be good cross promotion for all the titles involved.
All right. Now, going back to Spider-Man, one of the big storylines that I can remember was one of the first ones came, was when Peter's parents were brought back.
Right.
Was there any idea where that story was going to go?
You know, it's I'm curious what led you to ask that? Is that based on your reading of the stories or stuff you've read?
Yeah, I was just curious about it. It's one of those stories that's kind of stuck out in my head for a long time because it was one of those first ones I came across. I think I came in toward the end when they'd been revealed as being something sinister.
Right. But I mean, I guess did it seem to you that it was, you know, that it didn't, I guess you were asking that, did the story seem like it didn't know where it was going to go as a reader?
No, I was just curious. I had a Steve Englehart on the other day, and I was asking him about some storytelling he'd do, and he talked about sometimes how he would throw plates in the air, where he wouldn't know where something was going to go, but, you know, he figured it out once it hit the ground.
You know, that was a common way of doing stories in the 70s. And probably even in the 60s. I think by the 80s and 90s, I think the universe had become so interrelated that I can't say that didn't go on, but I think it went on less than it had. So Spider-Man's parents, that's one of those things where I can clearly say that was my idea, for better or worse. You know, it seemed like a thing that had not been, you know, the only time they've been touched on was in that early Spider-Man annual, Amazing Spider-Man annual, when it was revealed they were S.H.I.E.L.D. agents. And probably, you know, I would imagine, you know, this all ties together sort of, you know. I think in researching the Marvel saga and even What If, you know, you just go, well, gee whiz, we haven't seen Spider-Man's, any stories relating to Spider-Man's parents in years and years and years. Wouldn't it be interesting if these characters, if his parents had returned? I mean, here's a guy whose entire definition of who he is based on, he's an orphan. His parents died, you know, when he was just like, what, 3 or 4 years old. And he was raised by Uncle Ben and Aunt May. So what happens to your life if you have this self-image and this idea of who you are and who your parents are and were, and suddenly they've returned? What does that do? So, you know, so my idea is to bring him back and then have them turn out to be not really them, but part of a master plan by an enemy. You know, we knew that's where we were going, and I think then the various writers embroidered that, you know, and then we were coming up with the clone storyline and the you know, it tied into various things we were setting up, and it became an element in sort of tearing Peter Parker down to rebuild him. The trickiest thing with the parents, and I don't know if there was any, you know, ultra satisfactory solution, but I decided that that it was worth taking the risk and figuring out was that if somebody's a danger to Spider-Man, then wouldn't his spider sense go off and alert him about them? So I think the way around that was that the androids who were posing as his parents themselves believed they were his parents. And it wasn't until the chameleon kind of literally flipped a switch and put them into menace mode that the spider sense went off. You know, again, I think that was the part that was the toughest, but I just thought it was worth playing fast and loose with the spider sense, which is really pretty much the only way to play with the spider sense, since it's in essence a magical power. I thought the only way, I thought we could get away with playing fast and loose for the various benefits of having the parents back. So that, so I would say that I and the writers that I worked with knew where it was going. I know I've read a quote from one writer in particular who said, we didn't know where it was going. That is not true. we may not have had every T crossed and every I dotted, but we knew in a general sense and even in a specific sense. We certainly knew, as an editor, if fan response was so great that Spider-Man's fans demanded that his parents really be his parents, then, I guess I would have had to consider whether to make them really new and that really, really them. And then, of course, what do you do then? Do you just have them around as sort of like supporting players, or do you kill them all over again for a dramatic impact? But that was really, certainly in those days, there were certain characters who had been established as having died and were never going to be brought back. I don't know. I think the only one who may still be in that category these days is Uncle Ben in the Marvel Universe. I don't know if there's anybody who no one has brought back.
I don't know. Give it some time.
Right. Well, I'm sure on a monthly basis somebody proposes a story where Uncle Ben, either comes back to life or was never really dead. Characters have a 50 or 75 year existence, and eventually someone will pitch that story, and eventually some editor will say yes, and then it brings me back to when we were doing the clone storyline, and we knew it would be controversial. And maybe I even said this to you in our last interview, but, we were sort of planning, and we were going, a lot of fans won't like it, and there will be a lot of backlash, but it'll be interesting and exciting, and hopefully we'll raise sales. And Tom DeFalco said, and anyway, the guys after us will change it back anyway. So, and it turned out that's what happened, So, that, it is, as Robert Crumb said, it's just lines on paper, folks.
One of the things you're mentioning, Spider-Sense, the way I always interpreted it as a reader is that it was something that would have to be very immediate, like someone was about to punch him in the back of the head. That's when it was bring on.
Well, but over the years it was established, that as having different levels. And again, because it was in essence a magic power, that would be, the question is, though, when you say about to punch him in the head, at what point does the danger start? Is it when the person starts thinking about punching him in the head? Is it when the fist is a foot away from his head? And I've seen it played both ways. Assuming that we live in a dangerous world and there are always, say, various nuclear missiles being aimed at New York, I think there's sort of a background buzz that comes and goes that Spider-Man has sort of learned to live with and ignore in terms of the more immediate danger. If he's in a store and somebody comes in with a gun in their pocket with the intention of robbing the store, that might be one level of danger, whereas then the guy pulling the gun out is another level. It became over the years a nuanced power and very inconsistent too. And ultimately we did try to define it, but depending on who the writer or editor or artist is, that power is more or less sensitive, you know, which is why I say, you know, sort of his other powers. I mean, look, in a way, there's a way that superheroes are all magic. You know, their powers are we choose to explain them in terms of pseudoscience, but they could just as easily be magic powers. I think it's easier to define them and put specific limits on them when we call them science. And we did that with the spider sense. So that was our rationalization for the parents. It's like, okay, they're androids. They think they're his parents. They even, as deeply as androids can feel, they think they love him and they think they have sentiment attached to him. And it's not till their programming is changed by remote control that they suddenly, maybe you could even look at it as almost. And I'm sure I'm about to offend like any psychiatric professionals or people who suffer from various conditions in the audience, but I would guess, imagine you were dealing with someone with what's known as a bipolar.
Right. No,
right? I understand. So someone might well be nice and well intentioned, and then they would go into a more negative view. Again, I apologize for misunderstanding years of psychological research.
No, I've got it myself.
Yeah, so I think that would be a real life equivalent. Anyway, but that's the spider sense. I've got to wrap up soon, so maybe one more question, Victor, and you probably have to wrap up too.
Yeah, it'll probably be a few more minutes. I was just going to mention, you were talking about how some powers are magic, because, I do some writing myself, and my friend does art, and he'll sometimes ask me, and said, I don't think that's how zombies work. And I said, well, why don't we go check the encyclopedia of crap that doesn't exist?
anything like that, as long as it's consistent within your storyline and your particular universe,
right,
is the important thing. No, exactly, zombies are the perfect thing. I mean, there is no one way zombies exist, but within a given fictional universe,
right,
they should be consistent.
Story.
Yeah.
Right, that's what I said. I said the only thing that you have to be beholden to is what you're doing yourself. If you're true to what you're writing, it doesn't really matter what anybody else does.
Right. Exactly. And if it's consistent within the story, and then if you do other stories with the same set in the same universe, they should be consistent as well.
Okay.
But right, there are.
You finish.
Oh, I was just saying that. Yeah, there are no, since there, as far as we know, there are not zombies or superheroes. Then it's up to the creators and the caretakers of those characters to determine, what can and can't happen and what is and isn't real.
Danny, thank you for talking to me again. This was, I really enjoyed this, and hopefully the listeners did.
Hope so.
Is there anything you'd like to plug before you go?
Let's see. If you're in the New York area, I'm doing a whole series of events, and I'm also teaching a comics editing course starting the end of this month at a place called the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. It's sohodigart.com. Would have the information. Or just Google my name and Soho Gallery, and you'll come up with the different items. And I think at some point we're going to podcast them as well. So some
All
other
right.
stuff I can't talk about, but you will be the first to know.
Okay. Thank you, Danny. You have a great day.
You too, Victor. Thanks a lot. Take care.
All right. You too. Bye. And, folks, we'll see you hopefully next week, and I'll try to line up. Hopefully I'll have some new guests lined up. Bye-bye, everybody.